Hans Bolter interviewing his grandfather, Rabbi Freeman, on January 2nd, 1994.
This is testing to ascertain whether the batteries work.
Okay, where were you born and when?
I was born in Baltimore, Maryland, around 19, somewhere between 1913 and 1915.
Did you have any siblings?
I have one brother and two sisters.
What did your father work at? What was his job?
My father was the Hebrew book dealer in Baltimore.
So, I mean, I know during the beginning of the 19th century, I mean the 20th century, many Jews were forced to quit their jobs every Friday because they would have to work on the Sabbath. So
my father had to quit his job too, because he would take a job, and you couldn't tell anyone there then that you were a Sabbath observer. Right. So he would take a job and then work on Friday. And then tell the boss he's a Sabbath observer. So most times he was fired because they didn't want it. They want a person to work on the Saturday as well. There was no such thing as not working on a Saturday.
But once he owned his own business, he didn't have that problem, did he?
No, that's why when his father was getting a little older, and he needed someone to take over the business, he suggested that my father take care of it. And he had the business until he died.
So what kind of schooling did you have in Baltimore?
I went to the first public schools. There were no yeshivas at that time. And it was just about getting organized. Rabbi Schwartz Zatzal had organized the Baltimore Parochial School, which is now known as a Talmudical Academy. And they were in the little houses, it wasn't advisable to go there at the time. I went to the public school, elementary school, and had very good teachers. And I had one teacher, Ms. Bernstein, that my father insisted that I have her for the fourth and fifth and sixth grade, because she had an excellent penmanship, and she trained everyone to write beautifully. And that's the start of my career as a penman. I'm a sofer, a scribe. I was a sofer of Boston for 25 years. And I really got my start in her class. Then in junior high school, I went to public school number 40. Then there was no such thing as busing. That's ridiculous. Everyone rode. You took the streetcar. If you couldn't walk it, you took the streetcar. But public school and the junior high school were within walking distance. The elementary school was about 3 blocks, and the junior high school was about 9 or 10 blocks. But everyone walked it. And there I had one fabulous math teacher, who inspired me and gave me an excellent background in mathematics. Then for high school, I went to the Baltimore City College, which was a high school that I had to take 3 streetcars to get to it. But no one thought anything about it. That's the way it had to do, so you had to be. So we took the streetcars. And at the same time, now at my that was my secular education. My religious education, I went to a teacher. They used to have teachers who would teach in their own homes, One room of the house was devoted to the school, and they taught children from 4 years old. I went to Hebrew school. I started, I think I was 4 or 5, who remembers? And I went straight through until my bar mitzvah to the same man. He happens to be Rabbi, that is Jason Rosenblatt's great-grandfather, was my teacher. And after bar mitzvah, I went to a private Rebbe for Talmud, who was excellent. He was an old man, but he was excellent. Also went to his house. And after a year or two, he had recommended that I go to this new parochial school. They didn't have, they just had the English department and elementary division, but for the high school, everyone went to the public high school, and they went back and went and came to the yeshiva and studied there. There I was fortunate to have the Rosh HaYeshiva of the yeshiva, Harav Samson Zatzal, who was a fabulous teacher of Talmud and gave me a real background in Talmud. And the now I look back, practically all the boys of my class were rabbis, and later on became rabbis. And that we went after high school. I remember high school finished at 2:30, and at 3:30 we were scheduled to be at the yeshiva. And we learned at the yeshiva from 3:30 to 7:30 every night with him. And sometimes if they were tired, they would give us a class in Nach. Yeah. But basically, it was Talmud.
It must have been hard balancing the two.
No, it wasn't hard. We went to the, I left the house at about 7 or a quarter to 7.
How did you work out going to shul before school started? So davened.
You couldn't go to school before school started. You davened at home.
You had to
because you had to leave the house about a quarter to 7.
So you had to wake up really early.
Sure, you got up early and you ate breakfast and you took your lunch. For lunch, you could buy a lunch in the high school cafeteria. This was a beautiful school, school.
They had kosher food?
No kosher food. You could buy an apple.
Right, but you can't buy a good lunch.
No. Everyone, all the religious boys took... took their own lunch, and the religious boys would sit on the corner of the cafeteria.
Did anyone ridicule the Jewish people?
Naturally, they ridiculed us for wearing hats while we ate. That was the only ridicule. While no, it wasn't much. It was sort of an expected thing. A Jew wears a hat when he eats. That's where the was, and we weren't molested. I wasn't molested. I had a very good friend. I remember Tim McCarthy. They used to call him, this is Tim McCarthy and Friedman. We studied together, we worked together, and he sat with us too and ate. And it's surprising he didn't learn the pension. He wouldn't make fun of us. But some of the boys would make some remarks, but they always had teachers there, and they didn't let any rough stuff take place. But you have to expect a little, and we used to bench too, bench out loud. The boys would eat. That was expected. And everyone sort of ate amongst groups, and They ate that way, and as some of them used to cross themselves before they eating, would we say anything about that? That's their religion. Let them do what they want to.
Right.
You see, the principal of the school was a Dr. Frank Blake. We didn't know it at the time, but in addition to being principal of the high school, there must have been about 3,000 students. In addition to that job, he was professor of Hebrew at the Johns Hopkins University. And we learned about that in a very strange way. When one of the boys of the yeshiva decided he wants, instead of taking French or German, he wants a credit for Hebrew. So they said, that you have to go to the principal. And he didn't know that this was the professor of Hebrew at the Johns Hopkins. So he started, and so Dr. Blake said, all right, let me see how much Hebrew you know. And he was amazed that he himself was going to examine him. And he started at the derivation, the Arabic and Aramaic derivation of the words. The boy didn't even know what he was talking about. And the result was, he said, oh, nobody, I can't give you any credit for Hebrew. You don't know any Hebrew. You may know Talmud, but you don't know a basic Hebrew.
So what did you do after high school?
After high school, I went, there was an interesting thing. We were at that time, I remember we were seniors at the, when we were seniors in the yeshiva, the old Lubavitcher Rebbe came to Baltimore, and he was treated, I saw the president coming to Baltimore.
Yeah.
He was given more honors than the president of the United States. It was a fabulous scene to see how the mayor and all bowed down to him, Hendler's, Mr. Hendler of Hendler's Ice Cream had a Rolls Royce, and the Hasidim got the Rolls Royce from him and gave the driver a good bottle of liquor, because they wouldn't let the driver have the schus of carrying the Rebbe. And the Chossi, they gave him a bottle of liquor when they started. They said, when we finish, we'll give you another one. And the Hasidim were standing on the sideboards of the car, just like the Secret Service is when the president comes, but much more intense. And then our graduating class got a interview with a Rebbe.
You got to talk to him?
And he examined us in Talmud. And at that time, and my father was known as the ardent Litvak, the biggest opponent of Hasidism, because he didn't care for many of the Hasidic rabbeim, because he claimed that they were not educated sufficiently. Before I went, I was told that I should behave myself. I shouldn't repeat any of the jokes about Hasidism, because this rabbi is a scholar, and my father says he'll tar and feather me if I make any derogatory remarks. And then we got in, and he started examining us, and I happened to know all the answers to the questions that he asked. And he said, oh, you're going to be a good old Be Yisrael. And right away, the Rabbi Samson got on the telephone and told it to my father, because it was the joke. He was known as the antagonist of the Hasidic movement. And he said, it's all right. If the Rebbe blesses my son that he'll be a Godel b'Yisrael, although it's the Rebbe, I take it as a blessing and as a compliment.
what did you do after high school ended?
After high school, I went to the Yeshiva University, and there I met Dr. Revel, who was the most brilliant mind I have ever met in my life. He was the founder of the Yeshiva University.
It was relatively new then, wasn't it? No.
It wasn't the Yeshiva University then. It was the Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan, and they had the Yeshiva College. And I went to Yeshiva College, I enrolled in the Yeshiva College, and I attended the Yeshiva. I was placed in Rav Polnayev's class. That was quite an advanced class. And he was a fabulous teacher as well. And I learned with him for a year. And then after the year, I was advanced to Dr. Revel's class himself. Dr. Revel gave a shiur twice a week. I've never seen anything like it. The man knew Shas page by page, by heart. Not only Shas, Rishonim and Acharonim that way. And he knew whether it was the third or the fourth line from the top or from the bottom. And he never used any notes. And always spoke of sugyas. He didn't believe. He says, if you don't understand the Tesis, so what? If Tesis doesn't understand, he said, Tzorach Inyana goes to the next Tesis. He said, but understand the concepts that are involved, whether there is Rove, when is Rove. I remember I heard about a dozen shiurim on Ruva de Yisakamon or Ruva de Lesakamon. And then Umdana, and would take you throughout the entire Shas, showing you the various aspects of it. The man would speak for 2 hours and never used a note, and always quote it straight through by heart. And when you got through, you knew a sugya. Then after that, I must have been there for 2 years. I don't remember how many years it was.
Before you go on to after college, just going back maybe a few years backwards, but how did the Great Depression that happened at the end of the 1920s affect your family, in the beginning of the 1930s also?
In 1930s, not in 1920s. In 1930s was the Depression when I went to the Yeshiva. In the 1920s, I was gone in the high school, yeah.
When you were in college, that's when
that's when the Depression was, so we had nothing to eat. And the yeshiva lost control of its dormitories. I had to stay somewhere, and the yeshiva couldn't, you see, at that time they would import European boys, European alumnim from the various yeshivas in Europe, so they should have an influence on the American boys. And so they had to be, the few rooms that they had, they had to be given the rooms because they had no place to go. But anyone else didn't have a place to go. I tried sleeping on subways. There's no place to sleep. Where am I going to sleep? There's no...
You didn't have any relatives in New York?
No, I had no relatives in New York.
Did some people have relatives there?
Some people who had relatives went to their relatives.
I think you'd rather go home than sleep in a subway.
I slept in, but I couldn't learn. The next day, I was... my mind didn't work. I tried sleeping on the bench, but it was cold. They didn't have any coal for night times. It was freezing. And so I went to the police station and asked them for a cot. So when there was no one there, they would let me sleep over in a cot. But if they had a tramp, that was locked up there. They wouldn't let me sleep. They said it was dangerous. You can never tell what these tramps will do to you. So I hit upon an idea that I will watch dead people. Mason.
Dead people?
Yeah.
As
people who died to the funeral parlor, Park West Funeral Parlor. I'll watch the Mason.
They give you a place to sleep.
And not a place. You're supposed to say till him.
No.
And there's nobody there. And all that they wanted is just someone to be there with them. Yeah. And so they used to give me a cot. And they used to put a sign on me, alive, that they shouldn't embalm me. Because the Mason were there, and I usually said, well, and there was one, seldom did I have more than one Mason, and I had a warm place to sleep,
yeah.
And I got a few dollars, I think I got $10 a night, and I had money to eat, and no one knew what happened to me. At 9 o'clock, I would leave the yeshiva. No one knew what happened or anything. And I went to the undertakers, and I was with the undertaker. I did that until after the Depression.
Right.
And I was the richest boy there. I had $10 a night. And sometimes on Saturday night, they'd give me a tip, give me $15, and put in three people in the room there.
Right.
Dr. Revel finally prevailed upon a member of the board who had control of the dormitory and wouldn't let anyone in. He had to give him a few rooms, and I was the first one to be given a room. Then I always had a room in the dormitories. And then when things started to improve, I was even able to pay, I think it was $10 a month for the room. And they gave you a room service too. They would make the beds for you. The maids would make the beds for you. Mm-hmm. All for $10 a month.
But your parents didn't send you money for food and stuff like that.
My parents didn't have enough to eat themselves.
Well,
and my brother, Avi Shalom, was a teacher, a high school teacher, at Baltimore Polytechnic Institute.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they got that at that time. A full teacher got $1,500 a year. He sent me a good $500 a year. He took the bread from his mouth and sent it to me during the Depression. Because every time, if my father had a few dollars, that bank failed. And he didn't have it himself.
Right.
Because
they wouldn't give you the money you had to pay them.
No, the bank failed.
Right.
The bank wasn't insured at that time. And when every cent that he could take from his own mouth, he sent it to me. He said that I should have something to eat. And then there were very lovely people around the yeshiva. They would bring us some meat. We should be able to eat meat, say, once a week. And on Shabbos, we were invited by the Balabatim around the yeshiva. Some Balabatim gave you wonderful meals. Other Balabatim would give you, they would say, every Zemira in the book. And I was hungry. I was starving. And I had to sit through all that Zemiras. Ever since I got a dislike for Zemiras, because I wanted to eat and they wanted to sing Zemiras.
Well, so then what happened after college?
I got smicha. I don't remember when it was. I studied much longer than was required because I wanted to know how to learn. And I got smicha, and after smicha, Dr. Reva wanted me to enter the Yodin Shir.
No, to be a judge.
Yes, is he a smicha has yera yera and yodin yodin. And he wanted me to enter the yodin shir, and they gave me a little job in the Bronx, a rabbi of the Bronx. Young Israel of Bronx Gardens. It was the most delightful experience I ever had. First of all, there were several scholars, real scholars, and I enjoyed delivering the shir for them because I had to prepare. And they prepared and they tried to catch me. I remember they tried to catch me in the Rav Kavega. But I knew what they were trying, and I prepared myself to be able to combat anything that they would say. Anything that they threw at me, I would just ridicule them. And if they would say, but the Rav Kavega says that, I would say, yeah, Rav Kavega said it, but you got to understand what Rav Kavega said. You, unfortunately, don't understand him. And so that's, in the beginning, then they didn't bother me, and they were my best friends. And I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it immensely. Because at that time, I was studying Yordan under Dr. Revel himself. And I finished all the requirements for the DHL, Doctor of Hebrew and Literature. Then, in the middle of the Yordan Shir, Dr. Revel, while he was arguing with one of the boys about Pshat, he said, let's take out the Gemara. What do we have to argue? Here's the Gemara. I'll show you. Yeah. And took out the Gemara and said, my gosh, I can't see the Gemara. Turned blind at the shir. And a few days later, he died. And I lost interest. I didn't want to continue taking the Yodin examination because I knew I'd never use it.
Right. So I
should have. Looking back, perhaps I should have taken it, but I didn't. And then the yeshiva. There was the war. The Second World War had broke out. And I was rejected because of my feet. They told me if you want to serve anyhow, we could use you in Atlanta, Georgia. And at that time in Atlanta, Georgia, was looking for a young rabbi. But the old rabbi, Rabbi Geffen Zatzar, vowed that he will not permit any young man into his shul. He spoke only Yiddish. No one in the congregation understood a word of Yiddish. There was one, Mr. Belensky, two, Mr. Belensky, Mr. Taylor, and the two of them understood Yiddish. And at the same time, I was introduced to a lovely girl, Judith Lichtenstein, and I told her that I think I'm going to Atlanta, Georgia, and she says, "Oh, that's nothing wrong with that." So I went to Atlanta, Georgia, and they were betting that I wouldn't last 1 week with the old man.
Why did the army want you to go to the show?
Because the army had a big base there that they couldn't handle. They couldn't get enough chaplains. And no chaplain wanted to do that work.
Why?
The work was at the Lawson General Hospital to meet all the convoys from the European Theater of War and separate the living from the dead and take care of the dead. everyone had a member of his family in the army, and the congregation was simply thrilled that I took such an active part in the army's work. I established a rapport with the older man, Rabbi Giffen, and I realized what his fears were. Here he was a rabbi for 50, 60 years before I came there, and he established this shul. It was his shul, and I sensed that, and I said to him, look, I want to be the associate rabbi. I don't want to be the rabbi. I have my domain with the youth and with the Hebrew school and with all the other activities, and you have your domain. And I said, there's a lot that I can learn from you, because I found out that he was a brilliant Talmudic scholar, and he was the authority for divorces in the entire South. Everybody came to him for that. And I said, I want to learn from you. And he took me in and treated me like better than his own sons. And we used to learn together. And then when he had a divorce, he'd ask me to be his aide. And when he saw how I signed the divorce, he said, hey, you write it better than the sofer himself. But I didn't write any divorces there. I'm interrupting because at that time I got married. I married Bobby, and the president of the congregation, Mr. A. Barabach, who was the southern representative of the Heritage Harrington Furniture Company, one of the world's great furniture company, gave us a whole house full of furniture. This furniture, this is 50 years old, all the furniture here. The living room, the dining room, and my bedroom set. The same furniture, and it looks like new. The most fabulous furniture a person can ever have. And then the B'nai B'rith got a hold of me and made me the B'nai B'rith chaplain of Georgia Tech, the university. And they introduced me to the federal penitentiary. And then there were a lot of religious boys in federal penitentiary, because who was in the chicken market, chicken business? And the black market and the chickens. And they were all sent to Atlanta, Georgia. And I had some Hasidim there and everything. We used to sit and learn.
In jail. Why did they end up there?
Because they were caught in the black market. Their parents were caught. Mm. And they took the rap. They didn't want their parents to sit in jail. Mm. And they took the rap. And I used to go to the Atlanta Federal Penitentiary, I think it was every other Sunday morning. And then they got me to go to the largest mental hospital in the world, Milledgeville. You see, there in Atlanta, Georgia, they all drank wood alcohol. Even the shamans would give wood alcohol. It made them blind and everything. And it was the largest mental hospital in the world. And I became interested in that, in the mental hospital and mental illness. So I saw my interest was shifting. You see, during college, I was a math and education major. And after college, I did a lot of work. First, I taught math at the high school, at George Washington High School. And then I organized a Hebrew school in Hastings on the Hudson, that's upstate I experimented in the Dalton method of education as applied to the Hebrew school. That's a form of education which the child is able to progress at his own speed. And oh, I was in it for several years.
But you left there?
No, I did that after school. That is at 4 o'clock instead of going to college.
Right.
I did that.
So did the school work out?
It worked out very nicely. I made out quite well and was quite successful. I told you I went to Atlanta, Georgia, and my interest shifted from education.
What happened to the school?
The school, I don't know what happened to it. They got someone else. Teachers Institute used to use it as a experimental station, and I used to supervise the youngsters whom they would send who were studying education. But I left all that. I don't know what happened to that afterwards. Especially when I went to Atlanta, Georgia, my interest shifted from math to psychology and became very much interested in psychology, and then there was Emory University there, so I took courses in Emory. And at that time, the population had shifted from one side of town to the other. And I bought a Ku Klux Klan university for a shul. It had 3.5 acres of land. The shul couldn't see why I wanted it. And I had the hardest fight in my life because the Ku Klux Klan didn't want me to take all of that area and make a Hebrew school out of it. I knew at the hearing, the only way that they measure is how many people are for and how many people are against. I lined up every Jewish person in Atlanta to come to the hearing.
Well, that's how they measure. They ask the people
there. Ask the people whether you're in favor or opposed to it.
What do you mean hearing? A court?
A court hearing.
Why did they
have Because I had to change the zoning. And they didn't, the Ku Klux Klan didn't want to change it. They lost the building, but they didn't want the Jew to get the building.
How did
they lose it? Forfeited it. They couldn't pay for it. And they wanted $23,000. And the shul couldn't see. They said, you'll never get it rezoned because Atlanta wasn't a liberal city. I organized a campaign at that. I remember a Friday afternoon in the city hall. The hearing was in the city hall. I had at least 3,000 people there.
At the court? At city hall?
They were all around the city hall. They couldn't get into the courtroom. And they were, the courtroom was, I think, the 10th floor of the city hall. They were all the way down and all the way around. And when the judge asked, who is in favor of, who is opposed to the zoning, about 25 or 30 Ku Klux Klan got up. Who is in favor of zoning change? The whole walls got up. Must have been thousands of people who got up and started yelling, and one told the other down the hall and around the blocks, and there was, oh, we're in favor. I got it. I was offered, and I paid for it out of my own money, $26,000. The shul couldn't see it. I got the money together. I paid for it. Then a real estate man offered me $100,000 profit. I said, nothing doing. I bought it for a shul. They wanted to build apartment houses there, 3.5 acres of land. I gave it to the shul for what it cost me. And we were in there, and I taught, and I had my Hebrew school, and I had youth programs all there. I kept on going there. Kept on going there. Don't forget, I went to Emory too, Emory University. Yeah. I took my courses, my master's at Emory University.
Emory University?
Emory in Atlanta, Georgia. Okay. And then And then when your mother was of age to go to yeshiva, I think she was 7 years old, and she was in a graduating class at a Hebrew school. I said, let's send her to either her mother or to my mother, either in New York to Bubby and Zadie, or to my mother in Baltimore. I said, she'll be taken care of. So Mama says, so Bubby said, nothing doing. A parent is supposed to raise a child. A grandparent spoils a child. So she wanted to leave Atlanta because there was no room for your mother, for Lippy. There was no, and you couldn't, I couldn't get a yeshiva started because there was one other rabbi who knew that I'll stay there. As long as if there's a yeshiva, I would still have been there to this day if there would have been a yeshiva. So he didn't permit it to start.
Why didn't he want to get?
He wanted to get rid of me because he didn't want to have as people would say, one day Rosh Hashanah they go hear him, the other day they go hear me. And he had the bigger shul. He had, I think, 1,800 members at the time. I was too big of a competition for him. Although we were good friends. What is that?
The rabbi who spoke Yiddish?
No, there was another rabbi who spoke English, a good English speaker, who didn't want competition from me. He wanted Rabbi Geffen there. Rabbi Geffen was no competition for him. I said, I'm sorry, my wife wants to leave. He said, we'll fix it. She won't want to leave. We'll build her a mansion with a private mikveh. Anything you say will go into that house. They built me a parish house. Here would cost at least $1 million. At the dedication of the parish, the shul. At the dedication of the shul. Sheriff Israel. At the dedication, we had 250 people in my daylight basement of the shul. All of the chaplains, Jewish chaplains of the entire world, were my guests in my dining room. Rabbi Geller.
At the dedication of the house?
No, that's later. I'm skipping later on. Not at the dedication. During the war, they had chaplains all over the world. So they had a convention of all Jewish chaplains in Atlanta. And my house, we were the hosts in my house. And they were all in my dining room.
Was that big?
About 50 people were in my dining room. What?
Was that big of a house?
It was immense. And when the mayor of Atlanta wanted to show how a congregation treats a rabbi, he brought him to our house. Because it was the most beautiful house, I think, in the in a beautiful area. I said, you don't understand her. That doesn't mean anything to her. Education means everything in the world.
How long did you live in the house for?
A year and a half. And after 9 years, don't forget I went only for 1 year. I stayed there for 9 years. Rabbi Geffen begged me not to leave. Everyone begged me not to leave. But Bubby, your Bubby, was insisting on a real Jewish education. And she heard that Rabbi Soloveitchik had organized a yeshiva in Boston. And she wanted to go to Boston, and her sister was living in Boston, too. She still lives there, and Charlie still lives there. I came to Boston. I got the position at the Sheriff Israel, Teferet Israel. And I was there for 36 years. I wasn't happy in the rabbinate because I felt I had more important things to do. I felt that the handicap needed me more than the so-called normal people. And I continued my education in pastoral psychology. I got my doctorate. I enrolled at the Boston University, and I went through their theological school because I wanted it in pastoral psychology. I became a member of the American Association of Pastoral Counselors. I became a supervisor of clinical pastoral education to teach others how to be chaplains. And at first I got a position as in the mental hospital as a chaplain. And then Harvard asked me, and I was Harvard's chaplain. I was assigned to the Beth Israel.
While being a rabbi?
While being a rabbi, because I told them I'm not interested in a full-time rabbinate.
Right.
I'm just interested in the weekend, that's all.
Right.
They gave me help. So I would come to shul every morning and have my secretary dictate to her at 7 in the morning, and I would rush off to the mental hospital. And then I worked, when I got my doctorate, I got another slot in the mental hospital. At first it was only a part-time job, then I got a full-time in the mental hospital. Half of the job was a psychologist,
yeah,
and the other half was a chaplain in the mental hospital. I was with the state for 35 years. I worked for Harvard, for Beth Israel Hospital, close to 15 years. And then there was no one to write divorces. And I had to have a divorce, but one of my members, he said, "Rabbi, you won't get me a divorce. I'm going to marry without one." So I said to the rabbis, "All right, I know how to write. I'll write it." And that was my mistake. Ever since, they wouldn't let me go. For 25 years, I wrote divorces, wrote approximately 2,000 divorces.
Why was that a mistake?
Because it was too taxing for one human being. And I sent the children to the yeshivas, and then sent them to colleges, and then sent them to universities. And your mother got her master's, Olympia got his doctorate, and each one got his education. And I was able to do all that. I was able to marry them all off. And I forgot to tell you, during that time, my shul was falling apart. The walls where I would fall, people would come with all plaster. The electricity was condemned. So I had to conduct a campaign while going to school. And while doing this, I had to conduct a campaign for funds.
And you go to school and the rabbi?
And the rabbi. And the mental hospital.
Which
mental
hospital?
At Denver State Hospital.
Denver?
Denver State Hospital. It was 20 miles outside of Boston.
Okay.
I had to go there, and I had to rush from there over to the Beth Israel Hospital, 30 miles.
Right.
And I would stay there as long as I had to. And sometimes I would come home, and my beeper beeped me, and I had to go right back again and stay all night with a patient that was passing away. I had to stay with the patient.
But you worked at the rabbi and you worked at the University Hospital
and at Harvard and wrote divorces and counseled. Counseled divorces. I wouldn't write a divorce unless I could counsel the people. Oh, that they loved more than anything else. I would show them that.
At the same time you did all this?
At the same time.
But not you go to school at the same time.
And some of the time I went to school too. And at the
time,
when I went to school, when I had to write my thesis, my doctoral thesis, I didn't sleep for 4 months. I didn't go to sleep. except on Friday night. I didn't go to sleep. I fell asleep. Because I had to work until 12 o'clock. I had to work on my jobs. And then from 12 to 6, I had to write my thesis. What is that on the... it was on the chaplain in the general hospital. What pastoral psychology teaches a chaplain how he is to function in the various aspects of a crisis hospital?
How much did I write?
I wrote a book. It had to be accepted, and oh, they loved that. That was my work. I gave you a sketchy picture. The whole thing is sketchy because can you picture running a campaign for money? I raised $750,000, had a mortgage for 3 years. And after the third year, I was able to burn the mortgage, paid off all the mortgages, all the debt. Now they have a building there that's worth, that's estimated at $4 million.
I saw it.
You saw it. All the weddings were in my shul. Was it? It was huge and beautiful. That, in short, is my life.
Have you met anybody influential or important in your life?
I think the most influential man that I met was Albert Einstein. You know, when the yeshiva had dedicated the medical school in his honor, he was there. He was the guest of the yeshiva. And I was the president of the student organization of the yeshiva. And it was my job to sort of be his aide-de-camp with him, to take him around to the various places all day and to be together with him and to show him and guide him. And we were together quite a bit of the time. And at that time, I was still interested in mathematics. And he asked me what I'm learning. And I gave him a general idea. And he says, well, let's discuss it. I said, Professor, No, that's not for me, for us to discuss. I'll show you the building, because after all, here's the world's greatest physicist, and I was just meddling in math and physics. I had no connection with that. I imagine that he was one of the great men that I met, and of course, at Harvard, I met all of their great, doctors and all that. I had a very fine relationship with them.
I wanted to get a general picture of what you think a major difference is in the way it was when you were growing up and the way it is for us now when we're growing up. What are the differences between how you lived and how we lived?
Well, we were poor people. And we were very happy. It was a small community. Baltimore was always a religious community. Not the way it is now. The Hasidim. No, we didn't. It wasn't as Hasidic as it is now. But there was always a nice Jewish population there. A religious population, and our shul, the Rosh Shul, was known as a shul of scholars, and it had it hid Rav Vorschlager Zatzal, who was offered the Rosh HaYeshiva to be the Rosh HaYeshiva in Tera Vadas, and he was the Rebbe of our shul, and they had the Rav of the shul, and it was... It's hard to evaluate and compare the difference. After all, it's a different society of 50 years ago and 75 years ago and as it is today. Things were different. Things were much cheaper. And and people didn't expect as much. I certainly didn't expect luxuries. I remember first when I went to the yeshiva, I wasn't accustomed to a heated room at night. We had no heat in our bedroom. And Bala gets just as cold air as it does here. And I had a thermometer. What was my thermometer? The water that I washed with in the morning when I got up, because we didn't have a sink upstairs. So we had cold water that you wash in Negelwasser. So if it froze, you knew it was cold. If it didn't freeze, it wasn't cold. So how do you get up after all? It's, and the weather like today, it's snow outside, and it's freezing. How did you get into bed? So we used to heat irons that you iron with, and they didn't have electric irons. It was gas. You used to put the iron on the gas stove. It got hot, and you ironed. So everybody took an iron with him and go to the sleep because you couldn't get into bed. The sheets were frozen, one with the other. So you had to get it unfrozen and to be able to get into bed. You can't get into ice. We had a little coal stove for two huge rooms, 6 yard by 6 yard by 13-foot ceilings, I remember. They were the sizes. And a little pot-belly stove. So if you stood in front of it, you burned your front. Your behind was frozen. Who felt like dragging coal upstairs and fixing the oven? You had to go an hour beforehand. So nobody bothered except when we had visitors. When I brought Bobby over for the first time, it was Thanksgiving. And we made the stove so that she should be warm. She froze there. With the stove, she froze. Sometimes the stove would freeze. You could sit on top of the stove. You didn't know you were sitting on it. So that was the life we lived. The kitchen had a nice warm stove, but the other rooms were cold. So we had a large dining room, also 6 by 6, 6 yards by 6 yards, and had a little gas stove in it. On Shabbos, when you close the doors and you put the gas on high, you can. It was on all night. You came down, you didn't freeze in the room. That was the way we lived, and we were all happy. And it didn't bother us. And we had the same young Israel. We had the Adas in Baltimore, and the Tarragons, the Tarragon family. They were the leaders of the Adas in Baltimore. And they were the most influential people here, too. Any other questions?
Also, you skipped one. The last most recent part of your life was after you left Boston, you moved from Boston to Silver Spring.
And I moved to Silver Spring. Bobby had died in Boston. It's already almost 12 years.
What year was that?
What
year was that?
I don't remember. So she passed away, and I was left by myself in a big house. We had a beautiful home. You know, Bobby was a builder.
Right.
And she took the ugliest home and made it into the most beautiful home. One of these old New England homes, the front yard was the Atlantic Ocean. So here I was in 16 rooms all by myself. Your mother and Debbie said that it's ridiculous for me to be all by myself. Hoover used to come to me weekends, but she lived far. I had this apartment before, I bought this apartment 3-4 years before I moved here.
Right.
Yeah, I bought the apartment. I had tenants in here. Mr. Friedman was a tenant. And